This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. The following is from the opening remarks of our March 29th show 2 months ago. In February, the Pew Research Center issued a report titled, What the Data Says About Gun Deaths in the U.S. More Americans died of gun-related injuries in 2020 than in any other year on record, according to recently published statistics from the CDC. That included a record number of gun murders, as well as a near record number of gun suicides. In 2020, 45,222 people died from gun-related injuries in the U.S. This was by far the most on record, representing a 14% increase from the year before, a 25% increase from 5 years earlier, and a 43% increase from a decade prior. This evening, we are focused on 21 of the people who will be included in the 2022 statistics. The following is from a recent piece in the Texas Observer titled, Greg Abbott is Full of Bleep. The author is Gus Bova, no stranger to this show. Here is one paragraph. The Uvalde shooter did not kill those children with his purported mental health struggles. He did not shoot them with estrangement. He did not murder them with malaise. He did not ravage their little bodies with the inchoate rage of his misguided youth. He killed them with a bleep assault rifle and high-capacity magazines, designed for the precise purpose of human annihilation. And a footnote, 3 years ago, the website Export Action reported that there are 13,905 McDonald's restaurants and 14,606 Starbucks stores in the U.S., compared with an estimated 50,000 plus places where you can buy a firearm. Good evening and welcome to the final episode of Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. Yes, we're live. You're not getting any benefit of editing tonight, folks. I'm your host, Bob Daly. I'm joined in the studio by Michelle Manning Scott and by Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. I'm just a little nervous tonight, you know? This is our final episode. Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle, should be dropping by shortly as well. Good to see you two again. I haven't seen much of you in the last 2 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think the last time we were in person was St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
March 17th.
It was. Yeah.
2 years ago. 2 years ago?
2020.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we had the brief membership drive show.
Yeah, we were in here a few times.
For those.
But I remember that night well because I went over to your house afterwards and you pulled out your fifth of Irish whiskey.
And it's gone.
Well, that's a good thing.
It's a good thing. And many more. But it's good to be back.
We have kind of a loose format scheduled for you here tonight. We went back and looked at all the topics and different people that we've spoken to in 4 years now in this show. and having a hard time
with the statistics really, of that, the numbers.
Beating it down to something manageable. So we're just going to kind of bounce around here for a little bit tonight. This will be much more free form than our usual show. But I did want to start off with just a few comments about Uvalde and, you know, Buffalo for that matter. Jim, you just had a memorial service last Thursday. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. This is yet another one that we've had, interfaith service, and all kinds of folks showed up. And what struck me about the sorrow that people were feeling and expressing was how all of the traditions, faith traditions, went in chanting. Everybody that was there, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, everybody had some kind of singing, chanting, you know, and it was an interesting observation, I think, about what happens with the human spirit when this sort of tragedy, horrible tragedy, when we're talking about kids. So it was good. And I think the good part of it, too, is that this isn't just something to do, but it's also a call of action.
Yeah.
You know, that we've got to hold these politicians accountable, as so elegantly stated in the article. You cited the piece of, I guess we can't say it, but...
Greg Abbott's full of bleep.
Yeah. You know, it's just the unconscionability. And you can see it. I mean, what was really interesting to me was the action in Canada yesterday, suspending handgun sales and banning AK-15s. Of course, all the countries were experiencing tragedy, as we have, Australia and New Zealand, have moved. Mm-hmm. And we just can't seem to do it because of the power of money that lies in the NRA. That's really become a very right-wing tool, I think, of the economic establishment. But we did that. And then there was another memorial on Saturday on the east side over by Pan American Park that, again, was interfaith. It would be nice not to have these, but I think also it would be more than nice not to have them. Yeah. It's a tragedy to have them. But I think we've got to keep this fire going to get politicians accountable. It's unconscionable where we are right now.
You know, my first reaction last Tuesday when I saw the governor on TV after the news came out was to think back to this show we did in March where we talked quite a bit about HB 1927, you know, the constitutional carry, in which Abbott last June, signed into law the eradication of licensing of firearms in Texas for all practical purposes. You know, my sentiments are very much with Beto saying this one's on you, Governor.
You know, what struck me about that press conference that you're talking about with the governor is that from that press conference, he went to a fundraiser. You know, he had his plane over there in East Texas, and he could have shown up in Uvalde. And that makes you wonder what is going on in his mind that he can have this lack of compassion and humanity, you know. And I think only the fact that the public raised the question, I mean, I'm sure he would have been at the NRA convention on Saturday. But this is what we're dealing with. This is the lack of political leadership that we are dealing with in Texas and throughout the nation. And this is a long struggle, but I hope people stick with it and we eventually will get there. But it's very tragic, very tragic.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said here. I would add there's a lot of accountability that's missing here.
Yeah.
And as a woman, and I'm a white woman, I will say that there's a lack of accountability by a lot of white men in the state. And then that's, you know, that's the top of the tier here, isn't it? So I can't accept that there's not a lot of that involved and that that's not been addressed properly in a lot of circles.
And I think we have to be really careful about focusing on the police response, which was awful, bad. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't become a way of diverting attention from the guns that are at play here. That's the thing that I think is really important. It's really fascinating, I think, you know, for us to go off on that police rabbit trail, but that's what it is.
And in Uvalde, don't forget, the majority of the police response was by the top people that are there are Latino. So it's, again, it could become an easy diversion for, again, the white male leadership in this state to push that off on them once again. Suddenly he'll want to hold those people accountable when, in reality, that's just a, as I said, a diversion for the arguments here.
Any of these arguments that don't go at guns are just distractions.
Yeah.
Totally.
We're going to take a real quick break here, and we've got somebody else to bring into the studio, so stay with us. Okay, we're live back in the studio here, and Austin Sanders has joined us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right, Bob. It's good to see you, Jim, and Michelle in person.
Yeah, this is this is all very strange, you know. I mean, we've been staring at computer screens for the last 2 years, and you have somebody with you here.
Yeah. This is my son, Eli. Eli Sanders. Eli, do you want to say something?
No.
You want to say hi?
No.
He's a little shy.
Well,
understandably.
Welcome, Eli. You're on a radio show right now.
Pretty cool. I think Mommy and Penny are listening.
Oh, yeah? Well, if you think anything, don't hesitate to throw out an opinion here. That's the whole nature of the show.
All right.
We're so glad you could make it, number one. I was thinking back to this afternoon about when you first started joining us. It was really with the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
You've really taken the last 10 minutes of the show each week. We're so grateful for that, you know. You've always done a great job with the Austin Chronicle, and you're right up on top of so many significant things that have happened in this town in the last 2 years, you know. That's for speaking into, Eli. Anyway, you know, I was just reflecting this afternoon about some of the major events that have occurred here since the pandemic. Going back to 2020, the Black Lives Matter marches, you know, on the heels of the murder of George Floyd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to say Forbes. George Floyd. Locally here, Michael Ramos.
Mm-hmm.
And all the injuries that are coming to light now from the APD response to the to the demonstrators, you know.
I would actually be curious of your assessment of where the police department is right now and where the monitor's office is right now.
Yeah, well, there was, you know, unfortunately a fatal police shooting just a few days ago. Officers exchanged gunfire with a man in Southeast Austin and ended up killing him. So by that metric, police killings in Austin and around the country are still happening. Still struggling to get, you know, kind of eliminate those, which, you know, the police department says they agree should be the goal, agrees with community members. As far as the, you know, the police monitor, Office of Police Oversight, it's been a very tense relationship since that office was kind of rebooted, I guess, 5 years ago now at this point. In 2017, when the contract between the City of Austin and the Austin Police Association, the labor contract was negotiated, oversight of the police department and police officers and accountability in general was the kind of linchpin, right? That was the really difficult topic to get back. And here we are, you know, 4 years later, negotiating a new police contract, and it's the same thing, where the push and pull over transparency and accountability is the central sticking point in this new round of police negotiations, which, you know, again, Bob, you mentioned the killing of Mike Ramos, right?
Mm-hmm.
That and the overall response to protesters in 2020 is really still on the minds of advocates pushing for more transparency and oversight over the Austin Police Department. So those negotiations are still ongoing, but I would not expect whatever the outcome is to improve the relationship between the department and the Office of Police Oversight. You know, kind of by their nature, they're confrontational. You know, they're kind of at odds with one another, at least the way that police departments are used to doing business, right? Jim, you'll well know police departments and chiefs and leadership often feel, you know, they don't have to share all information that advocates or members of the public want to be shared. And the Office of Police Oversight exists to get that information before the public. So there's always, I think, going to be a tension there. Regardless of the outcome of this new labor contract, I'd expect those attentions to continue.
This is almost deja vu of the conversation we had 4 years ago, right, mm-hmm. on this. But what I wonder about, I mean, I think inevitably it's going to be confrontational. I mean, mm-hmm. structurally it's going to be, right? But I wonder whether the monitor's office or whatever it's called now is actually doing the job that it ought to be doing in terms of getting this out in front of the public.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think the staff there, I think, is committed to being transparent and holding the department accountable and presenting this information to the public. I know that the kind of structure, the leadership structure within the city manager's office has been kind of a hindrance at times. The director of the Office of Police Oversight, that position reports directly to the city manager, right? And so, of course, city manager oversees all of the city government, including the chief of police in some regards. So I think sometimes there is some tension there where the city manager, as kind of overseeing both of these offices, the police and the monitor, there's sometimes tension that arises between the manager trying to balance both of those interests. And in fact, that's why in May 2021, Austin voters approved a charter amendment that would later allow the city council, if they choose, to kind of change that organizational structure. So the Office of Police Oversight would report directly to the mayor and city council rather than the city manager. This is how the city auditor in the city government works. The city auditor, they don't have a boss outside of the mayor and council. They have a lot more agency to kind of navigate pretty thorny issues. Bob, I think we talked about an audit they did of the city's response to Winter Storm Uri, and it was not kind. You know, it was not, they didn't, you know, pull any punches. And so I think that's something that we may see down the road is a push to kind of move the Office of Police Oversight outside of the city manager's office and that structure to kind of give the office more agency.
One of the amazing things in all of this after the fact now is that we've got 19 criminal indictments against APD officers for that behavior during the protests. And how many civil suits have now been, settlements have been approved? I think it's up to 5 or maybe 6.
There was another one a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Actually, 2 more indictments last week, right? Mm-hmm. From the same cases, 2 felony assault charges. Eli offering his 2 cents.
Yeah.
You know, at last I had heard, I think the city was up to about $15 million.
That sounds about right. Yeah. First and foremost, it's a heavy expense to the victims of this violence, but to the rest of the taxpayers within the city who are footing the bill for these expensive settlements. Yeah, that's just kind of another aspect of all of this.
So, I mean, how did that breakdown occur that you had such massive police misconduct?
I mean, that's a pretty big question. I think, you know, the police department looks at their response and says, we were responding to riotous behavior, is kind of their response. Mm-hmm. Protesters there on the scene will say people that were shot were not instigating or antagonizing, at least not in a way that warranted the severe injuries that many of the protesters have faced. I think it's a real question of tactics and leadership. If you look at the timeline, injuries began happening on, I think it was Sunday, May 30th, and people were being injured with the officers firing these lead pellet rounds, right, which the police department calls them beanbags, but that's really misleading because they are filled with lead pellet rounds, and they can really hurt people, as we've seen. Former police chief Brian Manley current chief, Joseph Chacon, who was an assistant chief at the time, they were watching this unfold. And they were hearing from city council members, from the city manager, from the mayor, from others, that this really intense violent response from officers needed to stop. But the next day, officers went out there and used the same tactics. So, you know, I think it's kind of tempting to look at these cases of police violence and maybe write them off as an officer kind of, you know, in the moment responding in a hot-blooded situation. And perhaps that happens sometimes, and even in May 2020 in Austin. But those tactics, the leadership at the department, seeing what was happening and not really changing anything from Saturday to Sunday or Sunday to Monday, you know, the day-to-day, I think is kind of a big part of the explanation.
Well, I mean, that's what bothers me about Chacon. You know, is he really in the position, or will he have the will to actually, or the knowledge, to change? I mean, this was systemic, what happened, right? This wasn't something that just occurred out of the blue. I mean, mm-hmm. this reflected the systemic training and procedures of the police department.
You're right, yeah.
And Chacon was part of that,
yep.
as was Manley.
Mm-hmm.
And making Chacon then the police chief, I mean, are we really going to see any change? Or the next time we have demonstrations like this, are we going to see the same kind of tragedy unfold?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big question, right? And what you're describing is perhaps the primary reason that justice advocates opposed Chacon as chief, or really any internal hire from taking over this position. As you mentioned, Chacon, you know, has more than 20 years of experience at APD. He came up within this culture, right? These systemic issues and training and response. It's a real pressing question if someone with that experience, that career experience, can be an agent of change within an organization, any organization, that has such deeply rooted cultural problems, especially one like policing, where there's this sense of loyalty and brotherhood and towing the line that makes it much harder to affect change. So I think it's still a little early in his tenure to really begin to answer those questions. I think there are things to point to that are promising, other issues, but it's a legitimate question that you raise.
You know, you're talking about systemic responses. When you think about the APD budget that resulted from soon after that, and then reimagining public safety, Save Austin Now, ultimately with its Prop A last November, it's almost like they're trying to attack all of this from periphery, and you know, you just got to wonder if really they'll get at the systemic issues.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot harder to address the systemic issues, right, as we've seen with efforts to reform the APD's police academy. It's stalled and had all kinds of challenges, and you know, the third-party audits reflect that maybe some of the changes are not being made effectively, are not taking hold among cadets and graduates. And really, those kinds of changes that are being instituted to curriculum and teaching methods at the academy, it's going to be difficult to say if they're effective until those officers are actually spending time on the streets, right, and interacting with people, and if they are truly policing in a way better aligns with, you know, community standards within Austin.
So, Eli, do you want to be a writer like your father?
He walks away, mumbles, I don't know.
Has he ever gone down to the Chronicle offices with you?
Yeah, we've been there a few times. He runs around the halls and plays with Hank, our three-legged dogs.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's it been like for you personally to cover all this stuff? You didn't see any of this coming, you know, in the last 2 years. I mean,
I guess when the pandemic started, Eli was about 2 years old, and then a year into the pandemic, my wife, Leticia, and I, we had another baby. She's 1 year old now.
Yeah.
And so they have really been, the three of them have really been a solve to all of this, right? It's been a lot of journalists, including myself, I would say, have gone through burnout and, you know, kind of being up close with all this trauma. It can really take its toll, but I've been really fortunate to have my immediate family and then a lot of other family and support in the area that's really helped me kind of navigate all of this difficulty. But yeah, I feel grateful also to really have had the opportunity to talk with as many people as I've had, family members affected by some of the issues we've talked about, people directly affected, people in power to try and, you know, hold them to account for supposed changes and promises made. So yeah, I'm grateful to have the opportunity to do that for our city.
Well, it's sort of vicarious for us. I feel like we've had a front row seat on the show here, having you cover all this stuff in great detail. So,
Thanks for that. And I've said this before on the show and to you, but I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about my coverage regularly in kind of a different context. You always ask good questions, and it's been nice to have that opportunity, you know, every week to kind of showcase some of the work that I do.
So, Eli, here's your chance. So let's see, he's got his mother and his sister and some other people probably listening right now. And
you want to say hi real quick?
No.
Say, my name is Eli. All right. Okay. I told him he didn't have to. He told me he didn't have to if he was shy. All right.
So what's going to be your take on the election, city election for mayor?
I feel like it's a little early to say, especially mayor. I think things will start to heat up July, certainly August, when the filing deadline passes. But, you know, we've got two established, pretty strong candidates, Celia Israel and Kirk Watson, who are known to varying degrees in the city, will both be able to raise a lot of money. I think they'll offer varying degrees of progressive visions for the city. I think that's kind of standard in Austin. But the question is kind of, you know, execution, right? You know, Watson, of course, was mayor years ago, but we live in a much different city then, and politically and electorally. So it'll be interesting to see how each of those candidates is kind of courting voters.
And we've got another city council person running too, right? Or is it just three candidates now?
Yeah, Kathy Tovo is a District 9 council member who says she's running. She's filed a treasurer. She hasn't formally announced.
Okay.
So it's kind of unclear what her plans are. And then Jennifer Verdin is running. She challenged Allison Alter in District 10 in our last election and took her to a runoff in that race. But she's pretty hardcore Republican, and Republicans only make up 25% or so of Austin voters. So she's kind of a long shot.
Well, it's your last chance, Eli.
He turns and walks away.
All right. Well, I think we're going to do some more station business here. But before we do that, again, thank you so much for all you've done for the show. And thanks for driving in here this evening.
I was honored when you invited me to come down in person for the last show. And glad I could make it work. Hopefully Eli wasn't too disruptive.
It's great.
A little home crafting in the background instead. We're in the reverse here.
Just
keeping an eye on the furniture here.
Right, community radio.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Me? You can talk about not having to look at your
face. We're back on the air, Jim. Oh, man. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Let me see if I can remember how to work the board here. I think we got the right mics on.
Yeah.
Along with Michelle Manning Scott and James C. Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. We were just talking with Austin Sanders here, who's been really an integral part of the show for the last 2 years. Let's go back to one of the founders of the show. I remember calling you and saying, you want to do a radio show on co-op?
Yeah, it's amazing how you get sucked into things. So, you know, we were talking during the break, or at least I was, about what struck me the most, or if that was something to talk about. And I think the thing that always impressed me were the people who were organizing in the community, you know, that we're talking. It sort of breaks down to me, like, we got three groups. We have the organizers, we have people that are sort of the new bureaucracy, if you want to call it that, in the nonprofit world typically. And then you just have some folks that are out there doing stuff. This is like the academics that we've had, you know, the very specific programs that we've had, the uncovering part of our history or dealing with the Supreme Court. But the thing that's always impressed me the most was just listening to people who are organizing and their struggles. You know, yeah. You can see, you know, a lot of things that people have to go through, very basic things about driving one place or another and talking about that. What happens when they show up in court and the judge doesn't recognize them, all of that kind of stuff. So it's been, I think, very impressive for me that way. So
organizers, I think about Shoshona Krieger and BASTA, you know, and thank God that they and the Austin Tenants Council have been around these past 2 years, you know. Think about the number of people, you know, on the verge of eviction, you know.
Exactly. And those are the people that are really inspiring, I think.
Exactly. You
know? That was one thing that always struck me whenever I was thinking about helping Bob find guests for this program was, that rang in my ears a lot, was when you mentioned that, you know, the people we should be speaking to are the people on the ground doing the work out there that really moves the needle forward. So I was always trying to think of those, like, where are we going to find those people? Who should we be reaching out to?
It's helpful for them, you know, to be on the program.
Yeah,
it
definitely
helps them build their constituency.
Yeah.
But it also helps them think through what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think it helps the community too, because there's so many organizations in Austin and beyond Austin, obviously, that, you know, people have never heard of and don't know that they're out there doing that kind of work. And I think it's very important to bring those voices to the forefront, and, you know, they really do need to be heard because they are the ones doing the work.
And it's very easy, you know, given the way we consume news and its negativity, to really appreciate that there are hundreds and hundreds of people out there doing a lot of good work on the streets.
Definitely.
And support them.
Yes.
To the extent that we can do that.
I think of some of the remarkable people that we've had. You know, I think about Steve Vladek, who's been on here 4 or 5 times, you know. Every time he's been on the show here, I'm just in awe. I mean, the guy's just like an encyclopedia of law and insights about what's going on in the court. You know, it was just 2 weeks ago we had him on again, 2-3 weeks ago, talking about the big Supreme Court leak, which was kind of beaten to death in the press. But he had wonderful insights about when this has happened in the past and, you know, what this really signals about what's going on. He talked about one of his pet peeves, and that was the whole shadow docket, the way that the court is being subverted, really, by an administrative process that was never intended for that use, you know.
You know, what's good about Steve, too, that's always very impressive. I mean, this guy is Act One person, right? He's on TV all the time.
Yeah.
You know, he's writing New York Times, all that. And he'll take his time to come on to the program, right? Which has a much more limited audience, and he doesn't bat an eyelash. He'll just do it, you know. And as you say, Bob, you know, conveying his knowledge and his enthusiastic way that he analyzes stuff is certainly, I'm sure, enlightened and enriched your intrepid audience, who will mourn your departure and await your return in glory.
So I will still be around co-op. I do some operation type work, engineering work behind the scenes. Especially during the pandemic, there was a team of us that basically kept the station on the air. Each one of us, there were 7 on the team, each one of us took a day of the week and made sure that there was something on the air from midnight to midnight.
Yeah. So, I do know Bob has given a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to this station the last 2.5 years. There's no doubt about that.
Well, anyway, we'll still, you know, now that we're not pre-recording things the way we used to, the task has become quite a bit simpler, but I'll still continue on that team. There is work to be done yet there. And I'll substitute from time to time, too. And who knows? Once I recover from this, I'm honestly just really burned out right now. But
this is a lot of work to do this show.
Well,
we've talked about that many times.
We'll keep this whole thing going, you know, for sure. In terms of favorites, I think we've met some remarkable people who have investigated history here, and you lined up Jeff Littlejohn for us, you know, talking about the Texas Lynching Project, which
yeah.
I still listen to excerpts from that. It kind of blows me away, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of history that we don't know. Yeah. And, you know, as the saying goes, you don't know what you don't know. That's one thing I say anytime the show comes up is it's a lot of work, but I've learned so much. I know more about the city of Austin's history than I know about any other city I've ever lived in my life because of the show, because I've had to do the research behind talking to these guests. So it's been a journey for me. I've really appreciated everything that it's given me.
And these two guys we had on, Ben Johnson and John Gonzalez, I think it was from UT, this Refusing to Forget project dealing with the Texas Rangers and the Mexican lynchings that were going on here in Texas back around World War I times or pre-World War I.
You know, and what's really good about that too is you see people actually now being able to delve into our history and get it out in front of us. And you can tell that's working well because of the legislature's reaction against it, right? That it undermines the Texas myth.
Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do is play one audio selection. It's from last February, February 8th. We talked with the Austin Justice Coalition. We spoke with Chaz Moore, who's the executive director, and Chris Harris, who's the director of policy. AJC has been at the forefront of racial justice in recent years here in Austin. You may recognize Chris as a co-op veteran programmer and volunteer. So let's hear those excerpts.
Trying to pull back and get some perspective on what all has happened, and so much has happened. The current climate that we're in, to me, is a little bit scary. The state legislature last year was about as regressive as it could get. Critical race theory, whatever that really means, has become a symbol for, well, really for white backlash. You know, you called it white lash before, I think. But we've got two laws now telling teachers what they can and can't say about slavery and the history of the U.S. We've got laws now prohibiting us from reducing police budgets, you know, whatever modest improvements or changes were made in that 2020 budget were quickly rescinded. We're fighting voting rights. Grassroots efforts are coming up with lists to prohibit books, 850 titles, anything dealing with racism or sexuality. And Trump seems to be totally unhinged now, using racist language and race baiting like he's never done before. So in this current climate, what's your take on things?
You know, it's just a lot going on, you know, but this isn't unlike, you know, any other moment in human history, you know, like there's always multiple things going on. As we talk about moving forward and building and creating more just, more equitable societies, I think it feels like a lot because, you know, especially this week with this current weather being where it is, like this coldness is something relatively new for us folks in Texas, right? Like we haven't been used to like this kind of sustained level of cold. And then you got the pandemic. But, you know, as far as the politics go, the stuff that's happening as far as voting and abortion rights and the ban on books, that's not new, right? That's very much of who the far right Republican Party has been, and very much, being honest, who we've been as a society, right? It's like, you know, again, and I said this a lot, with the pandemic, we had what I like to call like this 9/11 effect, because I very vividly remember for about 6 months after 9/11, unless you were Muslim or Middle Eastern, we, the country, had come together in this kumbaya type of hoopla, and it was, you know, proud to be an American every morning at school, and general sense of kindness and collectiveness around the country had just been like really, really great. And then 6 months later, we went back to who we were, and we kind of didn't change because we were being really, really terrible citizens and residents of this country to our Middle Eastern and Muslim brothers and sisters. Same thing with the pandemic, right? When the pandemic first appeared, you know, everybody's, oh my God, this is tragic. And we all did the right thing. Most of us, very large part, stayed in the house and getting our vaccines. And then a couple months later, what is this vaccine? And this is all a hoax. This is the government trying to tell us what to do with our bodies and all this foolishness, right? So it's just who we are. It's just who we are. And that's why, like, folks like us and Chris and other organizations that do system transformational work are in existence, because we're trying to create a new mode or mind frame or something, thought process for us, so we can just be better and do better as folks that are inhabiting this planet. But yes, like, does it suck that we're still talking about voting rights? Because I thought we got this settled back in 1964 and 5. Yeah, but yeah, you know, it just, you know, like, Chris is going to say something way more elegant and poetic and structured, but I'm just like, I'm not surprised by the shenanigans we're seeing. You know, like, Ted Cruz is saying it's racist that Joe Biden wants to get a black woman. It's just like, what? And this is the same guy that was in Cancun this time last year. You know what I mean? So it's this is us. This is who we are. And the only thing we can do is continue to get better and try to convert more people to the side of humanity and seeing all things that are good in humans and trying to do the right thing. And just know that there are going to be the Ted Cruzes and the Greg Abbotts in the world. And we have to collectively combat and fight against the ignorant and the hate and all the things that come with that.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't have much more to add to it. I would just say that right now, one, I think the forces that are pushing us backwards are very well organized, and they've gotten organized because they're able, through fear, they're able to whip their supporters into a fearful mindset. And they're able to do that because of the success that folks that are pushing for various, you know, justice in various realms, whether it's education, criminal justice, economic justice, and social justice, have had and continue to have. And so really, it's just a challenge for us all to continue to organize ourselves and to match or beat their level of organization. When we see folks take over a school board, take over a library board with designs on banning books and banning certain types of teaching in the classroom, that should not inspire us to fear. It should inspire us to organize to do the same. But obviously, for the cause of more justice, right, in our communities and where we live. But I agree wholeheartedly with Chaz. You know, unfortunately, there's always been an undercurrent of this, and people like this, and communities and leaders pushing for things like this. And so we have to shed our shock and get to work.
How about my co-op colleagues, Jim or Michelle? What's your take on what's going on right now?
I'm totally on board with what Chris and Chaz said. I think that we have to be really careful that we don't work ourselves into a dither and don't keep doing the organizing. I mean, you look at our history, people went through a lot worse stuff than we're going through. And we're here because of what they did and how they organized and the sacrifice that we made. And I think our job is just to keep going forward and to understand that what we're facing, the wall that we run into, that we can jump over it or we can knock it down, but it's a wall that people have faced all through history. And not to lose our desire for change or get frustrated or just throw up our hands. And I think this is a big problem, frankly, is this attitude that we see going around a lot that we've lost, you know, that they're there. But I think their being there means that we just have to keep working. And we got to have faith that what we're doing is going to pay out down the line. It's not probably going to pay out in the lifetime of many of us, obviously, but it will pay out in the long range, just as the people who went before us has paid out. So I think part of our job, Jesse Jackson said, keep hope alive and keep organizing. That's the second part of it. So I'm totally on board with their comments.
I was just going to add, yeah, the state of things these days has certainly just made me dig my heels in harder about educating myself further and making sure that the people around me are paying attention, because that's pretty much what we all need to do.
So, Jim Harrington, can we still count on you for optimism here?
Oh, yeah. No, I think we have to have it. You know, there's a famous quote, Havlov did, Vaxel. Havlov, I can say his name correctly, the premier who broke Czechoslovakia away from Russia.
Right.
Hope is not the hope that we're going to see something, but hope is doing something because it needs to be done. And I think that's where we are. We keep plugging away. And we're so, should be so grateful for the people who have gone before us and to carry forward what they have done for us so that we can do it for the generations that come after us.
If we do not have hope, what do we have?
Yeah.
We're getting near the end of the show here. I want to be sure to spout out a few thanks. Number one, to both of you, Jim, for agreeing to do this from day one and for all the wonderful contacts that you've brought to the show and the wonderful insights week after week that you've been on. I'm very grateful for that. This show would not have been what it was without your input from day one. So thank you so much for all that.
Yes, thank you.
And Michelle, you came along right at the right time. I really appreciate some of the contacts you've made. We've had some really wonderful shows, and I know you were just learning radio as we all were with all this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me, as I've said before, come along for the ride.
Thanks, of course, for all the kudos, but you're the one who started the show, so.
Yeah.
And it's been, I think, a really great community service, so I think we're all indebted for the last 4 years of putting this together, and it's a lot of work, and it was a lot of work even more during the pandemic. It's a pleasure to have been on the show, and and I commend you for thinking of this and creating this.
Well, and I really want to thank friends from the Austin Chronicle. Austin Sanders was just here earlier with his son. It's just been great having him wrap up the show each week with local news and local insights about what's going on, particularly with law enforcement, homelessness, the city budget, just down the line. Also appreciate from the Austin Chronicle, Mike Clark Madison, the news editor there, has been on any number of shows, and his predecessor, Michael King, was on several times, you may remember. We miss him now, too, but it was great having him here. We also had Beth Sullivan, Mary Tuma, and Brant Bingaman were on at various points as well. Also, from the Texas Observer, just so grateful to Gus Bova for absolutely wonderful shows, and Mike Barajas, who is no longer with the Observer, but it was great hearing him. Wonderful insights into the prisons and the effect of COVID on the prisons and jails. His colleagues Sophie Novak and Lisa Olson were also on. And then here from the station, we've had Jill Bailey.
Who did our logo.
Yeah, she did our logo for us, you know.
How do you have a logo for a radio show?
Yeah, well.
We got a website, don't forget. Co-op.org.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, the good plug. Way to go, Michelle.
Early support from
Greg Ciotti.
Greg Ciotti and Undercover Greg. Evan Solis, who is off at Columbia School of Journalism, and early support too from Brianna Griffith, who's no longer with the station. The musical artist that you're hearing in the background is someone named Komiku, and that's been our theme song. The name of the piece is Couleur l'horizon, if I've got that pronounced correctly. So we'll hear the end of that, and I think we'll just sign off here. So
thank you to everybody who's made this program possible. It's great, great fun.
And keep organizing. Organize.
Thank you for listening to KOOP Hornsby Austin 91.7 FM, community radio for Austin since 1994. Co-op continues our 24-hour stream of music and local programming at koop.org, where there is also more information on our diverse programming schedule. Find us back on 91.7 FM tomorrow morning beginning at 9 a.m. Until then, KBRX Student Radio for UT Austin will broadcast on this frequency. Thank you for being part of your community radio station. Radio for people, not for profit.